And we welcome you back, our special guest, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, is Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Jennifer, first thing I want to say to you is thank you for stopping by. What an unbelievable book this is.
Thank you so much.
First of all, how did you get started when it came to Mary Tyler Moore? Why write a book about it?
That's a great question. There's lots of TV shows out there, right? Why this one? I was writing for Entertainment Weekly at the time as a full-time staffer, and I interviewed a lot of women in comedy currently, and they all, or I'd say many, many, many of them, cited this show as a huge inspiration for them, which of course makes sense because you're growing up in the 70s and you're a woman in comedy or interested in comedy, this is the only game in town for you in terms of role models. So that kind of interested me. And then once I started looking into it a little bit more, I also found out that it was the first show to hire many women behind the scenes to write for it, as opposed to maybe like, you know, a token one or possibly two, which many shows previously had. This was the first one to have many women writing for it and working behind the scenes as well. And I just thought that really lent itself to an actual story that I hadn't heard before.
As you started researching the book and started compiling, and I can't imagine the amount of work that went into this because all the folks that you had a chance to talk to, but give me a couple of aspects behind the story of Mary Tyler Moore and how it came into existence. A couple of things that, or aspects that really surprised you.
There were several, really, you know. I don't even know if I really realized when I first set out to do this book what an underdog story this was early in its conception. You know, I knew that it was breaking down barriers and whatnot, but I don't think I really realized just how much trouble they had getting it off the ground because of the fact that it was about an independent career woman. And this was still, you know, they were conceiving it in 1969 and shooting it in 1970. So things were a lot different then. And, you know, they wanted to have her be divorced. The network, CBS, absolutely said no way. So they compromised and had her just kind of vaguely getting out of a relationship. But there were a lot of troubles early on that I didn't know about. And even after that, you know, they shot a sort of practice run of the pilot and it went terribly and test audiences really did not like it. And the network really did not like it because it was a new kind of television show, both in its subject matter and its approach, which was a lot more kind of character-based comedy instead of broad, you know, wacky comedy like I Love Lucy had, which is great. But this was a whole new kind of thing. So that was really surprising to me. The stories of all of the women who got to write for the show and kind of, you know, it wasn't just that they got to write for the show, but they really almost like, they sort of begged and borrowed their way into these jobs. A lot of them had been working as secretaries at the time in Hollywood and elsewhere. And, you know, they're coming to this show through all kinds of connections, anything they could find. If their dentist knew someone, then they'd try to get a script to the producers through their dentist. You know, it was just, they wanted this so badly because they felt like it was actually possible for the first time for them. So that was really interesting to me as well. And also just the, you know, I had not really thought about how much the strong women in front of the camera on the show too really made it. I just hadn't really thought about that so much before, but not just Mary Tyler Moore herself, but Valerie Harper, who played Rhoda, and of course, Betty White, who is a legend, and Cloris Leachman, who's also a legend. There were just a lot of amazing women who came together on both sides of the camera to make this happen.
There are so many aspects about your book which really blew my mind. Because, you know, my perception of the Mary Tyler Moore Show was, well, she had a husband who was a television mogul. She was an established star coming off the Dick Van Dyke Show from the 60s. She's a beautiful lady. it came so easily to her. They show up, they do a TV show, it becomes an all-time classic, like vault-type material to this day. You hear that iconic theme song, and it takes you to that magical space, which is what great music is supposed to do. But even the visuals of her in Minneapolis and and on the street, you're right about that, how people to this day will try and go and see the some of the places they shot, the locales around Minneapolis, kind of just put that on the map. But behind the scenes, and you touched on this a little bit, but I want you to unpack this.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of things going on behind the scenes. She's not sure of herself. There are many false starts and stops with the program before they even got it to the airwaves. And there were many times where it looked dead in the water. And that, Jennifer, is what blew my mind as I read this book. It didn't come easily to these people. This was anything but an overnight instant classic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like I said, that's what surprised me so much. And you totally nailed why it surprised me, because you're right. It's like this, if it doesn't come easily to Mary Tyler Moore at Grant Tinker, well, it must not come easy to many of us, right? What I loved about that is, to me, a huge part of this book ended up being to just show how hard it is to make a great television show. Like, there's just, it's almost like the entire universe is against you, and it's amazing that there have been as many as there have been, because chances are it's going to be bad more than it's going to be great like this. And yeah, they had so many things that they had to kind of overcome. Like you said, she was insecure because she had had a run of bad career karma right before this. You know, she was coming off the Dick Van Dyke Show years before, but in the interim had done some terrible movies that she had been contractually obligated to make. Like the quintessential example that I always cite is she made this movie where she played a nun who fell in love with Elvis, who was a doctor. That is about as good as it sounds. I mean, it's kind of fun to watch, but it's really ridiculous. She also was in the notorious, to this day, flop on Broadway musical adaptation of Breakfast at Tiffany's. So she just wasn't feeling very sure of herself. And plus the fact that they did try to do something new. I think that's huge, and I think it's really admirable, because that's what gave them part of their trouble, right? Like, they could have, once she got the deal from CBS to do the show, she could have just decided, and I think this is probably what they expected of her, honestly. She could have just decided to do a show where she plays an adorable housewife, except this time it's named after her instead of Dick Van Dyke, you know? And instead, they chose some slightly edgier producer writers to create the show for her. Grant Tinker and she actually were the ones who picked James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, who, you know, weren't Carl Reiner. They weren't big names with lots of traditional comedy experience behind them. They were just working on this show called Room 222, which, you know, was acclaimed but not a huge rating success, and it was a little bit modern and edgy. It was about a high school history class that tackled real issues in high schools, and it had African-American lead. So I think that alone was what kind of ended up causing them some of their troubles, because then they had to fight with CBS over every little thing for a while until they became a hit. And that's why there were so many problems, and that's why it's so admirable of them to have done something a little bit different.
And I think what's remarkable is they were getting pushback at the network level. You know, it wasn't like today where, oh boy, Mary Tyler Moore, I don't know who you would compare her today in the modern game. I don't know if
hard.
Yeah, it is hard. I'm thinking, and I don't know, but anyway, today she gets a push. Today there's all kinds of vehicles to push the program on. Back then, as I read your account of it from the inside, they're looking at it and they're going, they put us in a time slot where you go to die. They're thinking to themselves, the network brass, as you unpeeled this through your research, they were thinking, yeah, we'll do this for a year, maybe a couple, maybe we'll get a couple seasons out of it, and then we'll bid her adieu. Nobody thought at least at the network level, they didn't think the show was going to be special, did they?
No, they really, really didn't. Especially, Steve, this is what happened, is once they got the script, or at least even the pitch, they were already kind of against it once the pitch happened, because this is a pitch where Jim Brooks and Alan Burns came in and suggested the divorce idea, and they absolutely loathed that at the network. And so once that happened, things started to kind of turn against them a little, and they didn't think these guys were the right guys to be doing the show, but Grant and Mary stuck with them. They really just wanted something more traditional, and it wasn't coming through for them. You know, if they read the script and they said they just didn't get it because it didn't seem hilarious to them. And like I said, in that kind of like big, broad, like, why can't she just, you know, get into some kind of wacky scrape and then get out? Like Lucy, why can't she be stomping grapes or testing chocolates at the chocolate factory, which were wonderful, you know, landmarks of sitcomery at the time, but they didn't realize there was something else to be done, which was kind of more quieter and more character driven and wasn't going to really jump off the page as like cartoonishly funny. So they were, and the drama involved that they got into their scripts from the very beginning, they were very good at combining kind of actual personal drama with comedy. And that seems so normal now, but they pretty much invented it. I always get nervous saying somebody's the first to do anything, because there's always something else somewhere. But I think they were definitely one of the first to do that on television and to do it with such finesse, and that was what was confusing. So, yeah, they didn't have the network on their side because the network just wasn't getting it in a really traditional way, and that's what they do, is they put you in a bad time slot, and then they ride out their commitment to you on a, you know, they'll commit to a certain number of episodes in a contract. And that was sort of the idea at first at CBS, until there was a very fortuitous changeover in leadership at the network. And then that's when things really started to change for the show.
Yeah, and if that doesn't happen, we may never be sitting here talking about what in my mind is one of the classic pieces of American television for many, many reasons that you underscore, and then there are others, just chemistry, the cast itself, which we'll get into here in a second, as we visit today with the author of Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, All the Brilliant Minds Who Made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a Classic. Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong is joining us today on the program. And Jennifer, I go back to that time where it was still fledgling, the program. Not only does the or is there doubts among the cast themselves and internally and the writers and everybody involved in it, including the star and the headliner in Mary Tyler Moore, who's doubting what she is, if the what happened on the Dick Van Dyke Show was just fluky and that was just going to be her only thing because she had done several other projects that had bombed out, as you said. Then the press gets a hold of the pilot and the first couple of shows, I guess, and they write things like, you quote TV Guide back then as saying that she was unmarried and getting desperate about it. They called Rhoda a man-made klutz. The New York Times called the show preposterous. I mean, they're basically getting ripped from coast to coast, and then somehow they get through that. How did they go from this, the fledgling entity that they were, and gain traction? What do you think the secret was?
Well, I think it is such an interesting story, too. Like you mentioned, the early press didn't get it either. And I really genuinely believe that a huge part of that is the fact that the network was so against it early. And, you know, people who cover the stuff for a living, people who cover the television industry, they hear stuff, you know, they hear rumblings, they know sort of what the expectations are. And so once they start doing all their prognosticating for the fall lineup, they take all of that into account and things start to go according to, you know, sort of the insider view. And so I don't think that they were even giving it much of a shot, because they just figured like, oh, it doesn't even matter anyway. Like, this thing is not going to happen. Nobody likes this, so whatever. Also, I think it was partly because of what I was saying earlier. It's a different kind of show that at the time maybe took a little getting used to for some people. I do think, I you know, I'm a little baffled by those really bad reviews, because if you watch that pilot now, you will see a perfect pilot. A lot of pilots, even for good shows, are not great, because it's a notoriously difficult form, you know, especially for a sitcom, 22 minutes to do all kinds of things, to set an entire show into orbit and characters and plots and make you interested and all of this stuff. So it can be really difficult. If you watch like the 30 Rock, you know, pilot today, you're like, eh, not quite there yet. But this is perfect. It's exactly what it needs to be. It tells you exactly how the show's going to be. The characters are there. I love it. But I do think, you know, maybe that's more to modern sensibilities than to people at the time. Once they got going, though, you know, things got more of a chance then, too, among audiences. There were only three major networks. So, you know, you're sort of held hostage by what is on the television to some extent. And that meant you could give things more than one chance. So people started watching at least a little bit. And then, you know, and the world wasn't, in fact, falling apart as the network had thought might happen to the show. You know, people weren't up in arms over the fact that there wasn't big broad comedy. They were kind of getting used to it. And then All in the Family started too, and that was even more different. So there was clearly this tide turning. And then over time, those two shows actually kind of ended up working together and playing off of each other a little bit and building audiences over time. And then once the Emmys came up for that coming, you know, for the next year, both of them got nominations, and that really made people pay attention as well. And so it kind of was this slow build that you don't see as much today because of different mechanisms in place in the television industry. But, you know, by the time they got through their committed number of episodes, they were strong enough to get a full order of episodes and then keep going.
I thought the fact that they were kissing cousins with All in the Family was really interesting, and you fleshed this out. But there was a writer, who was it, a director? There was somebody who left Mary Tyler Moore's show to go to this program and said, hey, no offense to you guys, I know you're going to do okay, but I'm going over here. That had to really bolster their confidence as well on the front end. If you can elaborate on that.
Oh, yeah. There was a director who went and did All in the Family because that was, you know, they just felt like that was so different that, you know, you couldn't pass up the opportunity to do it even if it failed. But yeah, I mean, they that was kind of a bummer for the Mary Tyler Moore Show at the time. But it turned out, you know, it's one of those things like all is well that ends well. And it turned out to be that once these shows have these really parallel trajectories and they kind of like really feed off of each other, and they represent these two very different kinds of new comedy at that time. And once they were on the same night on Saturday nights together and kind of like feeding off of each other's audiences, that really was where stuff started to gain momentum. And then, you know, we eventually get four years or so into the Mary Tyler Moore Show's run is when we have that incredible historic powerhouse of a Saturday night lineup with those two shows plus Carol Burnett and Bob Newhart and MASH, which, like, you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
No. I mean, you talk about something that's unduplicatable in today's television. That just, I mean, those are Hall of Fame. Those are shows that will be talked about 100 years from now. And for different reasons, as we visit today on the program with Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, Mary and Lou, and Rhoda and Ted. And let me tell you something. If you're a fan of Mary Tyler Moore or some of that early 70s comedy, this is an incredible read. I mean, one great story after another. And another thing that I was left with was how much the cast of this program, and so much of it is casting and just really blind luck when you get right down to it. You've got to choose people for these characters. And you paint a picture where, for instance, when Gavin McLeod walks in the room, they go, that's Murray. Or early on when, I mean, could you imagine anybody else other than Ed Asner at this point playing Lou Grant? I mean, the thought of that is mind-boggling. He is Lou Grant. You can't expound on that, just how perfect this cast was and just how well they got along. They were family.
Yeah, that cast, I mean, really the bottom line of this show, and honestly, if you think about any show that ends up being legendary, it's like nothing happens unless you have an absolutely outrageously good cast like this. This is, I can't even think about it without being a little bit stunned every single time. They had a really brilliant casting director working on it. They got lucky in that sense. A woman named Ethel Winant was the casting executive at CBS at the time, and she loved the show. She was one of the few early proponents of the show at CBS. And so she handpicked that cast, and clearly, you know, that made a difference for the show because it is tremendous. Like you said, it's like it doesn't even make sense in your head to go to imagine that Lou Grant could be somebody. It just doesn't make sense. But they had some trouble with Ed Asner at first. He seemed a little too dramatic. Great dramatic actor. CBS didn't have a lot of faith in his comedy skills. And in fact, that was not totally off because even the producers found that at first, you know, he was giving line readings that were so good in a sense that it was like too much. It was like scary, you know, when he did that famous interview scene with Mary in the pilot where he says, you know, "You've got spunk, I hate spunk," which is probably the most famous line from the show. He kept delivering it with so much drama. They were like, people are actually going to hate you and be scared. You need to not show that there's a little bit of a softy underneath, you know? So he had some trouble, you know, Gavin McLeod had originally come in to actually read for the Lou Grant part, which is crazy to think about now. But he really wanted Murray and he responded to it and they gave him the part that he wanted. And then, yeah, if you think about people like, I mean, Cloris Leachman just knocks it beyond out of the park. I mean, she always does, but she is Phyllis, you know, she really brings Phyllis to life in this way that I'm not sure they even envisioned at first. And she was one where, you know, the casting director actually just happened to know her and said, "No, trust me, she's going to be great." And they had very little evidence to go on at the time. She didn't have a huge stellar career like she has now. So they trusted that, and it worked. You know, Valerie Harper ends up kind of making Rhoda the sidekick into something all her own. You know, she's not just a schlubby sidekick like she was intended to be. She blossoms into this, you know, just as important a presence when she was on the show as Mary. And then in the later years, you get people like Betty White coming in, who was, you know, supposed to be just on briefly and was amazing. So, and that's all not to mention Ted Knight, who I feel like is so much his character, that he's so much that character that I, you know, there's just nothing else that could be done. And that character was intended to be much younger, intended to be a love interest for Mary, but the minute they saw him, they just said, you know, we need to have this guy and his sensibility instead. So yeah, the chemistry was astounding.
And a guy like him, what I thought was really surprising, I don't know if it was surprising to you, but he was a really insecure guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He was really, you know, he hated, you know, I just said he was his character, and he probably hate to hear that. He really got very sensitive about being so identified with a character who was supposed to be so stupid, you know, such a kind of like narcissistic, stupid guy. And so he was constantly begging for more storylines that showed a different side of him. He also, I think, probably just had a general insecurity about him that, you know, probably drove what was so brilliant about him. But what I love about his performance in that show is how he really does bring this other dimension. You can tell he was just this supposed to be kind of a nincompoop of a newsman who was good looking but stupid, and instead you can see that insecurity all the time in the character. There's like this and it makes him really vulnerable and really, you know, otherwise relatable in this way that you kind of thought we were supposed to hate him, but you love him anyway. And I think that's how the other characters respond to him, and they put up with a lot more from him because of it. But yeah, he was massively insecure, and it caused the most strife there ever was between any of the cast members probably came from that.
Which is really incredible, if you think about it. And, you know, so many little things about the show were just happy accidents. You know, you're talking about the Murray thing, and then you're talking about the Ted thing, and they constantly were having to evolve what their vision was instead of making these people fit into this tight cast. They kept widening the net, which I found remarkable. This was sort of a work that was evolving, even so much right down to the theme song. You talk about the behind the scenes on the theme song, and I'm a music freak, okay? And I've got, you'll like this, I've got a Sonny Curtis show laying around somewhere. I've got shows from all over the world, okay? And I just collect the people, and I saw his name, you know, and I thought, that's the guy, I looked it up online, I'm going to get that. So I'm listening to this concert, and in the middle of it, he goes, I'm going to play a song for you you may have heard. You know, he's doing a bunch of kind of rockabilly stuff, which is what he does. Mm-hmm. He's one of the crickets, you know. And then he sheepishly goes into the Mary Tyler Moore theme. And it's so bizarre in his set, and it's so odd. Yet at the same time, they just basically brought this guy and said, this is what the show's about. And he comes back with a theme song that's completely iconic. Isn't that how it worked?
Yeah, it was a really crazy, like you said, it was such a weird happy accident. And I do actually give the producers credit. I think that's a special quality to have as a producer, to be able to evolve your show to fit what shows up, who shows up, instead of the opposite. And in this case, you know, they hadn't even finished the pilot script. They just had kind of like an outline. And Sonny Curtis had a manager who knew someone, you know, it was typical Hollywood, who mentioned to him, yeah, this show needs a theme song. And he was kind of just trying to get work everywhere he could. And that was one thing he did. So he just took the outline and looked at it, and in an afternoon laid down that theme song and just called them up and said, who can I sing this to? And they were like, well, we really can't deal with that yet, but I guess, sure, why not? Why don't you come on over? And he played it for them, and that was it. That was the theme song. It was perfect. And as we know, it really is perfect. Like, it's such a funny story when they tell it, because, like, you know, this big hulking, like you said, rockabilly guy from Texas, from nowhere Texas, comes in and plays the absolute perfect iconic song for the single girl in the city. And that was it. That was just, they didn't even have to, they were like, all right, well, I guess the theme song is taken care of. I guess we'll get back to our script now. You know, it was just such a weird thing that happened. And I also give them credit for not then running around anyway and trying out 3 million other songs. You know, they just went like, no, you're right. That's it. Let's do that. And now we'll get back to making our television show. And it's so amazing. It's such a great song.
It's an absolutely incredibly happy, reach down inside you, we're going to make it, she's going to make it after all. You're kind of living vicariously through her. And then if you go back to the time period, you know, so much of that program is about, can this single gal make it in this man's world, you know? When you put it in that context, which is what you did for this book, which was how you came about this work, and it let me see this TV show through completely different eyes and through that prism, and you did an excellent job with that. And Jennifer, we're about out of time, but it has been really great meeting with you. And I know this book is now out on paperback, and it is available wherever books are sold through Simon & Schuster. Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, on the way out, let me ask you a couple final questions here.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, as you were doing this, who was the toughest to interview in terms of who was just the most private and the hardest for you to get on paper, so to speak?
That's a good question. They're such big personalities. Most of them are quite like, oh, here I am, you know. And they were all very, very sweet. You know, James L. Brooks is fairly private, doesn't give a lot of interviews, so I felt really lucky to have gotten him. And you know, the other person who's a huge presence here, who was difficult for a very specific reason was Grant Tinker. I actually did get to talk to him on the phone, which was wonderful, and I really appreciated it because wasn't sure that was going to happen either. But the problem with him is that he's so perfect that, like, that's hard as a writer. That's hard to kind of really, you know, nail, because, like, is there really nothing wrong with this guy? Could this really be true? But it seems to be the case, and it's tough to write. So, and it's really tough to interview him, too, because he just says, like, nice things about everyone else and kind of doesn't really want to talk about his own role in things. So I'd say in that sense, it's that whole, like, it's like when somebody asks you to give a job recommendation, they ask you, you know, what's this person's weakness? And you're like, oh, he's just too perfect. But it's true for Grant Tinker, so.
Incredible. I mean, just you did an incredible job pulling all this together. Again, I, you know, here's the thing about me. I'm not a praiser unless praise needs to be there. You did an incredible job pulling all this together, and it is a great read. Let me ask you this. Have you gotten any reaction from the staff, from the folks you interviewed, from the people that were involved in the show, from this work that you've put out?
Yeah, I have. I definitely have. You know, particularly, I probably won't surprise you that I became particularly close to the female writers who I depict in the book because, you know, their story really hadn't been told that much before.
Right.
And probably also because they're not like giant celebrities, you know, so it's a little easier to continuously have conversations with them and meet them for lunch and whatever, because they're not running around being on Dancing with the Stars or, you know, those sorts of things. So that has been really gratifying because they have been so sweet. They've been really nice, and they've come out and done some events with me. They have told me they've been able to sort of like reconnect with some people that they hadn't talked to in a really long time who read the book and then said, you know, then sought them out. So I feel like that for me was kind of the best thing that's happened from the book, was just feeling like I got to tell these people stories and they wouldn't have been told otherwise. And also kind of, I think, you know, a little bit of a return to that moment of glory, which who doesn't enjoy that and getting to talk about this wonderful thing they were a part of.
Absolutely. And all those years later to bring it back to life is remarkable. On the way out, let me ask you this, and I do thank you for your time today. Is there anything else you care to add today as we close our interview today?
Well, I hope everyone goes out and reads the book, because I really do feel like these people deserve to kind of have their moment in the sun yet again. They were really all remarkable people, and I genuinely admire what they did, because I think it's more important than just the fact that they made a TV show. You know, I think that was another thing that I loved talking about with this book, is not just the women, but the men who gave them a chance. You know, I think they don't like to think of it that way, because they just think they were doing their job and they were doing a good job, and they were, but they didn't realize, I don't think, that there were a lot of other men out there who weren't going to give these women a chance. So the fact that they mentored them and took them on, and, you know, it really helped to usher in a new era in television. And I think that that's really important.
Jennifer, thanks again for stopping by and visiting with us today. And it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. You too.
All right. And once again, I thank Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, and again, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. And make sure you check it out. It's out in paperback. And believe me, you will come back to me and say, hey, I really appreciate you recommending that, as we continue with more after this.